In keeping with this extraordinarily optimistic assessment, Wolfowitz also would assert that same day that oil exports likely would pay for much of Iraq's post-war reconstruction. It's got already, I believe, on the order of $15 billion to $20 billion a year in oil exports, which might finally be turned to a good use instead of building Saddam's palaces, he told the House Budget Committee. There is a lot of money there. He repeated the point a month later to another congressional committee, saying that Iraq can really finance its own reconstruction. As for an administration official who had told the Washington Post that the war and its aftermath could cost as much as $95 billion, Wolfowitz said, I don't think he or she knows what he's talking about. By mid-2006, the cost of the war, counting the expenditures in Iraq of all parts of the federal government, would be close to triple that. The Army wasn't buying the optimism. Retired Army Major General William Nash, who had led the U.S. peacekeeping forces into Bosnia, forecast that spring that the occupation would take 200,000 troops, almost exactly the troop total in much of 2004-05, if to the 150,000 U.S. personnel there are added 20,000 private security contractors and 30,000 Allied soldiers. At the time, Pentagon officials publicly played down Shinseki's comments, claiming he had been mousetrapped into making them. But a month later, when the Army chief was again on Capitol Hill, he was asked about them again. Yes, he told the House Defense Appropriations Subcommittee, he stood by his estimate of the occupation force that could be necessary in post-war Iraq. It could be as high as several hundred thousand, Shinseki said. We all hope it is something less. Wolfowitz's slapdown of Shinseki echoed for months across the military, said Senator Jack Reed, a member of the Senate Armed Services Committee, who as a young man had served in the 82nd Airborne. Not only was he honest, but he turned out to be right, Reed, a Rhode Island Democrat, noted 2 years later. He was treated very poorly. I think it's had a chilling effect, very destructive, corrosive. Inside the uniformed military, officers kept quiet, at least publicly. But their private unhappiness ran deep. A few weeks before the war began, one civilian deeply involved in Army affairs meditated on this sad situation. There is so much disdain in the services right now for OSD that it has just been reduced to, fuck you, whatever you want, we don't. If OSD ordered the Navy to build another carrier, the Navy would say it wanted sail power. It was not a healthy state for a military establishment to be in on the eve of war. As war was about to begin, everything was ready except for one thing, a real war plan. The official view at the Pentagon is that solid planning was done. The idea that the U.S. government had no plan for the aftermath of war is false, Wolfowitz insisted in July 2003. It was just, he said, that every plan requires adjustment once conflict begins. But many other participants disagree, as increasingly do military historians who have examined the record. Lieutenant General Kellogg was one of the senior members of the staff of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, overseeing systems for the command and control of forces. I was there for all the planning, all the execution of the Iraq war plan, and then later served in Iraq. I saw it all. But what he never saw was a real plan for Phase 4. That is, what to do after toppling Saddam Hussein's regime. There was no real plan, Kellogg said. The thought was, you didn't need it. The assumption was that everything would be fine after the war, that they'd be happy they got rid of Saddam. Despite the many studies and briefings done, wrote Major Isaiah Wilson, who served as an official Army historian during the spring 2003 invasion and later as a strategic planner in Iraq, there was no Phase 4 plan for occupying Iraq after the combat phase. While various offices had produced studies, he said, in a paper later delivered at Cornell University, there was no single plan as of 1 May 2004 that described an executable approach to achieving the stated strategic end state for the war. The reason for this omission, said Army Colonel Gregory Gardner, who served on the Joint Staff and then was assigned to the Coalition Provisional Authority, CPA, the U.S. Occupation Headquarters, as his last post before retiring, was that it was seen as unnecessary. Politically, we'd made a decision that we'd turn it over to the Iraqis in June of 2003, recalled Gardner. So why have a Phase 4 plan? Eclipse 2, as the Army's plan for Phase 4 operations was codenamed, was founded on three basic assumptions, all of which ultimately would prove false. These were, according to an internal Army War College summary, 1. That there would be large numbers of Iraqi security forces willing and able to support the occupation. Or, as the War College's Strategic Studies Institute put it in PowerPointees, availability of significant numbers of Iraqi military and police who switched sides. 2. That the international community would pick up the slack from the U.S. military. That is, significant support from other nations, international organizations, and non-governmental organizations. It isn't clear what this assumption was based on, given the widespread and building opposition to the U.S.-led invasion. 3. That an Iraqi government would quickly spring into being, permitting a quick handoff to Iraqi interim administration with UN mandate. When assumptions are wrong, everything built on them is undermined. Because the Pentagon assumed that U.S. troops would be greeted as liberators and that an Iraqi government would be stood up quickly, it didn't plan seriously for less rosy scenarios. Because it so underestimated the task at hand, it didn't send a well-trained, coherent team of professionals, but rather an odd collection of youthful Republican campaign workers and other novices. Nor did it send enough people, in part because of the poor quality and sheer lack of CPA personnel, the U.S. occupation authorities would prove unable to adjust their stance quickly when assumptions proved wrong. Because of that incompetence, the CPA would be unable to provide basic services such as electricity, clean water, and security to the Iraqi population. And so, in the fall of 2003, it would begin to lose the lukewarm support it had enjoyed.